Hey everyone, and welcome back. We are taking a deep dive today into something that might seem pretty familiar at first, but is actually way more complex than you might think.
Sounds intriguing.
It is. We're diving into Jesus's parables.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, those stories about lost sheep and good Samaritans and talents buried in the ground, those.
Yeah, of course.
We've got this really awesome academic lecture as our guide today, and let me tell you, it is blowing my mind wide open.
Yeah.
Get ready to see these stories in like a whole new light.
I am ready. What's so fascinating about parables is that they are so much more than just like simple stories. They're like these beautifully crafted puzzles that are just packed with meaning, and they're really designed to make you think.
Okay, so before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's back up for a second. I remember, like from Sunday school, that a parable is kind of like a little story with a moral at the end, right? Is that all there is to it?
Well, I mean, it's a good starting point, but the word parable, as it's used in the Bible, actually covers a wider range of figurative language. Think of it like this: Jesus was a master communicator, and he used all sorts of tools to get his message across, similes, metaphors, allegories, you name it.
So, like when he says the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, that's a simile, right? Comparing one thing to another using like or as.
Exactly. And then you have metaphors where the comparison is more direct. It's the difference between saying God is like a shepherd and God is a shepherd.
Okay.
But parables, they take things a step further. They're like extended metaphors, stories that create this whole world where you can actually see the comparison unfold.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get it. But what about allegories? How are those different from parables?
Think of Pilgrim's Progress, that classic book where every single character and place represents an abstract idea. The main character is literally named Pilgrim, and he's on this journey that subtilizes the Christian life. That's an allegory. Parables can be allegorical, but they don't have to be that one-to-one mapping of symbols.
So it's less about decoding, like these secret meanings, and more about getting the overall point of the story.
Right. And to really get the point, you kind of have to appreciate how these stories are actually put together. There's a reason why they've resonated with people for centuries. One of the things that the lecture highlighted is the work of Amos Wilder. He was a scholar who broke down the key elements that make parables such effective storytelling masterpieces.
Okay, let's dive into that. What makes these stories so special?
Well, first of all, they are incredibly concise. Even the longest parables are pretty short, with a single focused plot. This makes them easy to remember and retell, which was crucial in a culture where most people couldn't read or write.
Right, makes sense. It's like those campfire stories that get passed down through generations.
Exactly. And they usually have a really limited number of characters, often just two main players, which keeps things clear and straightforward. Plus, they often use dialogue, which brings the story to life and really helps you connect with the characters.
Yeah, that's so true. It's like you're right there eavesdropping on their conversation.
Another interesting thing that Wilder pointed out is the rule of three. You'll often see parables using three elements or characters to illustrate a point.
Ooh, like in the parable of the talents, where you have those three servants who are given different amounts of money to manage.
Perfect example. And that repetition of three emphasizes the different ways people respond to what they're given. It really makes the message that much more memorable. Parables also use repetition in other ways, like repeating key phrases or themes to really drive home the point.
Oh, I've definitely noticed that. It's like those catchy choruses in a song that you just can't get out of your head.
And then there's that element of contrast, what Wilder calls binary opposition. You'll often see good versus evil, rich versus poor, wise versus foolish. This creates a really clear moral landscape and makes the choices facing the characters even more stark.
It's like those old westerns, where you've got the white hat hero and the black hat villain.
Yeah.
You know exactly who to root for.
Exactly. And speaking of keeping you on the edge of your seat, parables often have these really surprising twists at the end. Wilder calls it end stress, and it's this brilliant way to make the listener actually think twice.
Yeah, like in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, where their positions are completely reversed in the afterlife. It's a total plot twist that makes you question your own priorities.
Precisely. So all of these elements work together to make parables incredibly engaging and thought-provoking. But there's another layer to all this that we kind of need to unpack. These stories, they aren't just cleverly constructed. They're using the storytelling techniques to point us towards something deeper, like they're windows into a whole other reality.
Okay, I'm intrigued. You're saying there's more to these stories than meets the eye. Tell me more.
Think about it this way. Parables work by drawing analogies. You have the story itself, the situation with the characters and all that, which is like a vehicle carrying a deeper message.
So the story is like a delivery truck bringing us this hidden package of meaning. I like that.
Exactly. And that deeper meaning, the thing the story is pointing to, that's called the tenor. To unpack this, the lecture draws on a book by John Sider, who's kind of a big deal in the world of parable interpretation.
Okay, so walk me through this analogy thing. How does it actually work in a parable?
Let's take a parable that often throws people off. The parable of the wheat and the weeds. Remember that one, a guy plants good wheat seed, but then his enemy sneaks in and sows weeds among the weeds.
Oh, yeah. And the servants want to go pull up the weeds right away, but the owner tells them to wait until harvest time. I always wondered why he didn't just get rid of the weeds.
That's the genius of it. The situation with the wheat and the weeds, that's our vehicle. It's something everyone in Jesus's time would have understood.
Farming was a big deal back then. So what's the tenor, the deeper meaning being delivered?
Jesus actually tells us straight up the parable is about the kingdom of heaven. Now think about the different elements of the story. The owner of the field represents God. The wheat represents the people who belong to God's kingdom.
Okay.
The weeds represent those who follow evil.
And the enemy who sows the weeds, that's got to be Satan, right? Trying to mess things up.
Exactly. And that harvest at the end that represents the final judgment when good and evil will be separated.
Wow. So it's not just about farming. It's about the bigger picture of how God works in the world.
Yeah.
And how good and evil are all mixed up until the very end. I'm starting to see how much depth there is to these parables.
And the thing is, there can be multiple points of connection between the story and that deeper meaning. It's not always a simple one-to-one correspondence.
It's like each parable is this multifaceted gem, and as you turn it, you see all these different flashes of insight.
That's a great way to put it. And speaking of insights, the lecture also dives into the sheer variety of themes Jesus explores in his parables. It's really mind-blowing.
Okay, you've got me hooked. Give me the rundown. What kinds of parables are we talking about?
Well, you've got your Christological parables, the ones that reveal something about Jesus's identity and mission, like the parable of the Good Shepherd, which shows his love and care for his followers, or the parable of the rejected stone, where Jesus compares himself to a stone that the builders rejected, but which becomes the cornerstone, powerful stuff.
Yeah, those are the ones that really tug at your heartstrings. What else?
Then you have the lost and found parables, like the lost sheep, the lost coin, and of course, the prodigal son.
Oh, the prodigal son. That one gets me every time. It's like the ultimate story of forgiveness and second chances.
Exactly. And those stories emphasize God's relentless love and how he's constantly searching for those who are lost or far away from him. But then there are also parables that challenge our notions of justice and grace.
Ooh, like the one about the unmerciful servant who's forgiven this huge debt, but then turns around and refuses to forgive a tiny debt owed to him. That one always makes me squirm a little.
Right. It's a powerful reminder that if we've experienced God's mercy, we're called to extend that same mercy to others.
So it's not just about warm and fuzzy feelings. There's a real challenge to these stories.
Absolutely. And there are parables that deal with practical matters, too, like how we manage our resources and talents. The parable of the talents, for example, is a classic story about stewardship and using what we've been given wisely.
Yeah, that one makes you think about what you're doing with your life, what gifts you might be burying instead of putting to good use.
And of course, you have parables about the second coming, urging people to be ready for Jesus's return, like the wise and foolish virgins, where those who are prepared get to enter the wedding feast while those who aren't are left out in the cold.
Okay, those end times parables can be a little intense.
Yeah.
But it sounds like Jesus covered a lot of ground with these stories.
He really did. They're parables that warn of judgment, parables that offer glimpses into the nature of God's kingdom, even parables where Jesus's actions become the story itself. It's like a whole genre of teaching, and it's just fascinating to explore.
So out of all these different types of parables, is there one that you find particularly intriguing or challenging, one that maybe you struggled with understanding at first, but then had this aha moment?
You know, there is one that comes to mind, the parable of the marriage feast. It's found in Matthew chapter 22, and it's always struck me as both beautiful and a bit perplexing.
Ooh, the marriage feast. Tell me more. I'm ready to dive deep. All right, deep divers, we're back and ready to tackle this parable of the marriage feast. It's one of those parables that has always kind of puzzled me. I get the basic idea, but there are some details that just make me scratch my head.
It's definitely a parable that has sparked a lot of debate and discussion over the centuries. I think that's part of what makes it so fascinating. You know, it challenges us to think deeply about what it means to be invited into God's kingdom.
Okay, so for those of us who might need a refresher, can you give us the quick rundown of the story?
Absolutely. So the parable starts with a king throwing this lavish wedding feast for his son. He sends out invitations to all these important people, but one by one, they start making excuses. They're too busy. They don't feel like it. Some even get violent and mistreat the king's messengers.
It's like, hello, RSVP etiquette.
Yeah.
You don't just blow off a royal wedding invitation.
Right. So the king is understandably furious. He tells his servants to go out into the streets and invite anyone they can find, the poor, the sick, the marginalized. And soon the banquet hall is packed with this diverse group of people.
It's like the king is saying, hey, my table is open to everyone. Come and celebrate.
Exactly. But then there's this twist at the end. One guy shows up not wearing proper wedding attire and the king has him thrown out. That's the part that always gets me. It seems so harsh.
You're like, what's the big deal about not wearing the right clothes? You'd think the king would be happy that the guy showed up at all.
That's where we have to dig a little deeper. Remember how we were talking about parables working by analogy? The story is like a vehicle, and it's carrying this deeper message about God's kingdom.
So what's the deeper message here? What's this parable trying to tell us about God's invitation?
Well, the lecture pointed out that for centuries, scholars have been debating the right way to interpret parables. There's been this tension between those who favor a very literal single-point interpretation and those who see more allegorical meanings, like, is every detail supposed to symbolize something specific, or is it more about the overall point?
I can see how that would be tricky. It's like, where do you draw the line between taking the story seriously and reading too much into it?
Right. And for a long time, interpretation was heavily influenced by this scholar named Adolf Julischer. He argued that parables only ever have one main point, and anything beyond that is just embellishment.
But it sounds like the lecture was pushing back on that idea, right? Suggesting that there might be more to it.
Yeah, exactly. Modern scholarship has moved beyond that narrow view. It's not that Julischer was completely wrong, but his approach sometimes misses the richness and complexity of what parables can convey.
So if we're not just looking for one right answer, how do we approach this parable? What are some helpful guidelines to keep in mind?
Well, the lecture emphasized a few key principles. First and foremost, we have to remember that parables are rooted in the historical and cultural context of Jesus's time.
So, like, we can't just impose our own modern ideas onto these stories. We have to try to understand them from the perspective of the people who first heard them.
Precisely. Imagine you're sitting there listening to Jesus tell this story. What would have stood out to you? What cultural norms or assumptions would have been challenged? For example, the idea of inviting everyone, regardless of social status, to the king's banquet. That would have been radical in that society.
It's like Jesus is turning the social order upside down.
Exactly. And then there's the detail about the wedding garment in that culture. Providing proper attire for your guests was a sign of honor and respect. So for this guy to show up without the wedding garment would have been a huge insult to the king.
Okay. So it's not just about fashion police. It's about showing respect for the host and the occasion.
Right. And remember, we also need to pay attention to the literary features of the story.
Yeah.
The structure, the repetition, those unexpected twists, those often hold important clues to the parable's message.
So let's put all this together. If we're looking at this parable through the lens of the original audience, considering the cultural context and the literary features, what do you think Jesus is trying to say?
Well, I think one key message is about the radical inclusiveness of God's kingdom. The king's willingness to invite anyone and everyone to the feast points to God's open arms, his desire for all people to experience his love and grace.
It's like that line from the prophet Isaiah, "Come all you who are thirsty, come to the waters."
Exactly. But the parable also challenges us to consider what it means to truly accept that invitation showing up isn't enough. We have to come clothed in the wedding garment of righteousness, which symbolizes a transformed heart, a willingness to follow the king's rules and embrace his way of life.
So it's about more than just saying yes to the invitation. It's about living a life that reflects that acceptance.
Right. And this parable can be a bit unsettling because it reminds us that there are consequences for rejecting God's offer of grace. Those who refuse the invitation or who come unprepared may find themselves excluded from the feast.
It's like that saying, God doesn't send anyone to hell, they choose it themselves.
Exactly. But ultimately, I think the parable leaves us with a sense of hope and wonder. The fact that the king throws this extravagant feast for his son, that he's so eager to share his joy and abundance with others, it's a beautiful picture of God's love for us.
It makes me think of that verse in Psalm 23. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Even when we mess up, even when we don't deserve it,
yeah,
God's grace is still available to us.
Beautifully said. And that's the power of parables, isn't it? They draw us into these stories. They challenge our assumptions. And ultimately, they point us towards the heart of God.
I love that. And I think that's a perfect place to wrap up our deep dive into the world of Jesus's parables. We've covered so much ground. from the basics of what a parable is to the complex challenges of interpretation. And we've seen how these stories can be both beautiful and perplexing, comforting and challenging, but always ultimately pointing us towards a deeper understanding of God's love and his kingdom.
It's been a real joy to explore these ancient stories with you, and I hope our listeners have been inspired to take a fresh look at the parables and discover the treasures they hold.
So until next time, keep diving deep, keep exploring, keep asking those tough questions, and keep letting the Word of God transform your heart and mind.